Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. At WRCT.org.
This is WRCT Pittsburgh. My name is Aubriana Bench, and I'm joined by my oldest brother, Andrew Bench. Today we'll be looking at a smaller borough located a few miles north of Pittsburgh called Westview Borough. Andrew and I both grew up in Westview. What you do right now?
Well, right now I work for the Allegheny County Health Department doing clerical work, but before I was at the county, I worked for Westview Borough for about 6 years. And while I was at Westview, I was an administrator that I did was I was tasked with digitizing Westview's archives. And it's a pretty small borough in terms of size, but over 100 and something years, you generate a lot of paperwork and has to keep certain documents, and they wanted to have a copy of them digitally in case something ever were to happen. So through that work, I became well acquainted with Westview's history, and I even started giving presentations at my alma mater. Very passionate about Pittsburgh history in general.
So let's go to the beginning of Westview. How far back does it go? Do we go to the 1700s or like?
Well, I mean, You can't tell the history of any place in America without all on land that once was used by Native Americans. So prior to any European settlement, there were many Native American tribes that were living in what is now Pittsburgh. As European settlers started to arrive, and as they pushed farther west, this forced a lot frontier. Pittsburgh was at the westernmost part of the frontier. And so Westview's history goes back to that. There's a guy by the name of Caspar Real who in the 1790s, I believe it was 1795, he was given land for his service in the Continental Army. So he was given this land, and at first he couldn't use it because there were the threat of Native American attacks. Eventually, after the it pushed the Native Americans out of the Ohio country, and he was able to settle, and he built a log cabin, which is still there in Westview. It is one of the oldest structures in southwestern Pennsylvania. It's actually a residential property to this day. It was turned into a weird hybrid cabin thing. You know what I'm talking about. You've seen it. So that's where Westview's history really starts, with Caspar Real. Eventually what happens is in the early 1800s, a group of settlers come together and they petition the courts to create Ross Township. Ross Township is partitioned from a vague name of an area within Ross Township. It's not until 1905 that a guy by the name of Frederick Martzoff gets the idea to build a community. He was a land developer. He had built houses across the United States, and he came to the Westview area and was so enamored by it that he bought 700 acres and decided to build a community there. And so really, it's Frederick Martzoff, who he's the father of Westview, if you will. So Caspar Real, he's born in the 1740s.
So he was old.
And so he was, but so he's a young man fighting in the Revolutionary War, and then he's in his midlife by the time he gets this land that is now Westview. Martzoff is born in the mid-1800s, I want to say. ...1907, so he wasn't around very long to see it. So no, separate time periods altogether.
So was there anything interesting going on between 1795 and the mid-1800s in Westview?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on your definition of interesting. So Westview, the reason part of the reason is obviously Pittsburgh is situated at the merging of the two rivers into the Ohio River, so it's a prime spot for industry. But the reason that the greater northern part of Pittsburgh, the North Hills, even all the way up to Erie, there's a road there that was built by Native Americans. It was a trail called the Venango Trail, and so Westview is situated right on the Venango Trail. It was an existing road that settlers could use, and so that made it very easy for them to leave downtown Pittsburgh and go north. And you could take it all the way up to Erie. There was a fort in Erie, so there were settlements all the way up. In terms of distinct events in the 1800s, I mean, that's when the population of Pittsburgh and the surrounding areas starts to go up, but it's not really until after the Civil War that Pittsburgh starts to industrialize. Mm-hmm. In fact, Westview and Ross were mostly farmland until the late 1800s. It was the country.
So the Venango Trail, is it hard to pinpoint when that first started? Because obviously it's still around today.
I mean, yes. We don't know for various reasons, which would be a whole other episode. We don't know a lot about early Native American history, so we don't know when the road was created. We know that they were using it for centuries prior to European settlers arriving. It was probably formed by ancient buffalo herds that were migrating. A lot of Native American trails, they would use trails that they found. So thousands of years ago, there were buffalo in this area that would migrate, and they probably beat that path into the ground over centuries, and then the Native Americans, why wouldn't they use it? It's less work. They don't have to build it. And the same with the European settlers. Once they arrive, there's already this trail here that goes all the way up to Lake Erie. In fact, the Venango Trail allowed, they sent supplies up the Venango Trail all the way to Lake Erie, and it actually was part of the reason that Commodore Perry was able to win the Battle of Lake Erie, because they were able to get the supplies up there during the War of 1812. Well, that's something going on in the 1800s.
Well, so now part of this trail is called Perry Highway after this guy.
So we're still using it.
Yeah.
Today. In fact, the Perry Highway that we have, Route 19, whatever you want to call it, it is more or less the same sort of path that the Venango Trail would have been. There are obviously variations, but if you start to research the history of a lot of roads in the area, a lot of them were once trails, because when Europeans arrived, that's what they started using as well. And so a lot of the roads today are where the trails used to be, including Perry Highway.
So circling back to Westview, or going back into that area, let's go back to when the Martzoff guy, you said early 1900s, when was it, when he passed away?
He died in 1907.
Okay. So wasn't it around that time when Westview Park first started or was founded? Mm-hmm. And that was a major thing for Westview, right?
Yeah, Westview Park was actually, it opened in 1906. So it basically existed as long as Westview had. Westview is incorporated in 1905, and then the park opens a year later. So as you can imagine, the park became an integral part of Westview. I mean, for 70-plus years, that was the heart of Westview. In terms of business and bringing people in to the area.
So because it was such a critical part of Westview, whenever it started, because you and I both know about when Westview Park started its downfall, but do you want to enlighten listeners on what happened with Westview Park? And
do you just want me to give you an overview?
Give an overview, because there were a lot of parks in the area where this kind of started happening, except for, as a lot of people know, Kennywood, which is still open. But
well, first, I will say I'm not the foremost expert on amusement parks. There is a guy, a Pittsburgh local named Mike Funyak, who wrote a very good book on Westview Park. So anybody who wants a deeper understanding of the park, I would check out his book called It's Westview Park, the T.M. Harton Story. But at the turn of the century, the early 1900s, these parks were really popular. There were dozens of them all over. There were many in the Pittsburgh area. They're some of the more notable ones are Westview Park, there's Luna Park, Kennywood. And it's because that's, at the time, that's what people were doing for fun. These parks were, I would argue that they thrived for two reasons. One, you may have heard Kennywood referred to as a picnic park before. It's because it was built on what was a picnic ground. And then the park, they would encourage people to bring your families, bring a picnic, and then go ride things at the park. Westview Park is the same. It started as a picnic park. The land was purchased, and then it became a picnic park where they would encourage families to come, bring food, and then ride things. You also have to remember that early amusement parks, you're not buying a ticket, and then you can ride anything. You're paying per ride. So individual companies would have rides at these parks, and they would collect some of the revenue from people. So they're obviously, these people want to build cool rides, so people come ride their ride. That's the whole thing behind Westview Park. So it's a picnic park. The other important thing is that it's situated at the end of a trolley line. Back in the day, we had a much more robust public transportation system, and you could actually take a trolley from anywhere in the greater Pittsburgh area to Westview Park. It ended right at Westview Park, the trolley line. So anybody could get there, and that was a huge, huge advantage for the park. People could easily get there. When the park's created in 1906, a guy named T.M. Harton, he's the one that creates it. He's already a successful businessman. He manufactures and operates amusement park rides. So he already has a company, and he does so well that he says, shoot, why don't I just make a park and I'll put my own rides in the park? And so that's what he did. He's a Pittsburgh native as well. He picks Westview as the spot for this park. And Westview Park is there from 1906 to 1977. Within 10, 20 years of Westview Park being created, it's the only park in the area besides Kennywood. So for most of the 1900s, the only two amusement parks in this area in Pittsburgh are Kennywood and Westview Park. And they didn't really compete with each other because they're far enough away from each other that their crowds aren't necessarily picking one over the other. So they existed, you know, just fine with each other.
Is there any reason why Westview kind of started seeing a downfall? Was it 50s? or
60s. So again, if you talk to some of the older residents in Pittsburgh, they'll often, you might hear, oh, well, Westview Park couldn't compete with Kennywood. Not true. They weren't really seeking to steal each other's customers. Westview Park is about 18 acres, but that's it. If you go to the Westview Shopping Center, that's where Westview Park was. It's pretty small. There's not a lot of space to expand, so by the 1940s, they've taken all the available land they possibly can use. Their golden era was after World War II. The baby boomer generation is their children at that point, so they are obviously going to the park. So in the 40s and 50s, Westview Park does really well. Starting in the 60s, attendance starts to falter, and honestly, even until they closed, their attendance wasn't bad. It just didn't continue to go up. Part of what happened, they couldn't expand anymore. That meant they couldn't put new rides in to attract potential new visitors. The other thing that happens is in 1973, there's a fire. Westview Park has a dance hall called Danceland, and Danceland was a huge spot where young Pittsburghers would go. A lot of people, older people in Pittsburgh, actually met their spouse at Danceland. It was a big deal. You'd go and listen to live music and dance. Well, that burns down in 1973, and they don't rebuild it. And that was one of the nails in their coffin. They just, as attendance faltered, they weren't able to keep up with the newest innovations, and so the park slowly declined. But even in its final year, 1977, attendance was not bad, but it wasn't great.
Kind of like a
slow decline. It was just a gradual decline, I'd say, from about the mid-60s to 77 when it closed.
So if it had closed any later, it probably would have been slower and lower attendance, you think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it probably would have become more run down.
Yeah. And so do you think the closing of Westview Park, or like the slow-ish decline, I don't know if it would be a decline because they close it, right, whenever attendance was barely going down. Mm-hmm. But do you think it kind of, messed up Westview, or kind of put Westview into a hard spot towards the end of the 20th century?
Well, yes, short answer. There's a couple, I'm an avid Pittsburgh historian. So Pittsburgh becomes a steel manufacturing hub, and up until the 1960s, oh, that's another thing I didn't mention. The population of Pittsburgh in the 50s and 60s is double what it is today. Well, when the late 60s, early 70s come around, a lot of steel jobs are leaving Pittsburgh. And so there is a gradual decline of Pittsburgh's and the surrounding area's population. So Pittsburgh peaked at over 600,000 people. It wasn't until the 2020 census that we actually stopped losing population. We've steadied out at about 330,000, I believe. So we have half of our peak. So you have less people living in the area. Westview is a picnic park, and so people would have school picnics, company picnics, union picnics at the park. Well, less jobs, less steel companies, steel plants, less picnics, less population. And by the time Westview Park closes, the steel industry is almost entirely gone. By the early 80s, Pittsburgh is at one of its lowest points in terms of jobs. And Westview not only has less of a population, but they now lose one of the biggest draws to the borough. The park had existed as long as Westview had existed. And so for that park to suddenly close, the borough kind of has an identity crisis. You know, it's like you're born with your right hand and then all of a sudden your right hand's gone the next day. That would be pretty bad. I mean, that's kind of how I think of it. They existed together for so long. And so Westview does experience a little bit of a decline in terms of population. And even today, I would argue Westview, I'm biased because I worked there and lived there, but they do a really good job at maintaining their public services, paving the roads, keeping the parks and the borough looking really nice. I'd say they're exceptional because I've been in a lot of municipalities in Pittsburgh. But the one thing that they've struggled with is getting good local businesses back in the borough. And that's a problem that a lot of municipalities face. How do you attract people to do business in your municipality? And there have been a few new businesses that have opened up in Westview in the past 10 or so years. There's a great Italian restaurant near our house, Severina.
Coffee shop.
There's a new coffee shop that just opened. So there are things happening in Westview. But there was a decline, and I don't think it was Westview's fault. I think it was just the trends of what was happening in the greater Pittsburgh area, coupled with the fact that Westview Park closed. Yeah, I mean, that's going to cause a decline.
What would you like to see in the future of Westview? Do you think there's anything that could fix? I mean, well, maybe it doesn't need to be fixed, but what do you think? Up the population, bring back Westview Park.
Yeah, that would be cool. I don't know that Westview needs to be fixed. I think it's a very nice place to live.
A good place to live.
Their motto is a good place to live. It is. It truly is. I enjoyed growing up there. I enjoyed working there. I think the thing that would help Westview the most is making it an attractive place for people to come to, whether it's restaurants or various businesses that are there, make people want to come to Westview, and also continue maintaining the public services so that new people want to move in. That's the only way you're going to get more people coming in, is keeping it attractive. And I think that they are doing a really good job at that. Westview is certainly a place that I wouldn't mind going back to live in one day. It is pretty small. It's only about a square mile, so that, you know, there's a limited number of houses. But I think those are the two biggest things, is attracting more businesses and continuing to maintain the level of services so that people want to live there. I think, yeah.
Is there anything else that we haven't touched on that you think would be worth touching on?
Oh, geez. I don't know, like what?
Oh, man. What's one of your favorite things in terms of Westview or Pittsburgh history to talk about?
I talked about it earlier. I find it very interesting how it was settled, why it was settled, the Venango Trail, people moving north. The early history of Pittsburgh around the French and Indian War, Revolutionary War period is really cool. The Fort Pitt Museum has a really cool exhibition going on where it focuses on the early history of Pittsburgh, in particular conflicts with Native Americans. I find that very interesting. And in terms of Pittsburgh in general, I think it's very fascinating how Pittsburgh has gone from a filthy, disgusting, horrible place to live in terms of environmental health, and through the efforts of various figures over the decades, we have turned that around and become more than just a steel city. In fact, Pittsburgh today would be unrecognizable to somebody living during the Gilded Age. There's healthcare here, tech, higher education, like Carnegie Mellon. So the fact that Pittsburgh was able to pivot itself and turn it into something new, you don't always see that with cities. There are still cities that are struggling to get their footing after losing a major industry. You know, take Detroit, for example, or, you know, Cleveland. Pittsburgh is unique in that way. It's unique in a lot of ways, but I think the fact that we've continued to be a cool place to live, it's pretty neat. And I think we're unique in that regard. Does that make sense?
Yeah. What key figures?
The Pittsburgh Renaissance. David L. Lawrence, who was the mayor. And then I believe it was Richard Mellon III. I'm going to have to fact check myself, but those two figures are responsible for reshaping Pittsburgh, cleaning up the city. The convention center is named after him for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously the school is named after the Mellon family, so those two figures. I should also mention that I used to work at the Frick. And so I know a lot of my other interest is Pittsburgh during the Gilded Age. But that's a whole other topic.
I'm doing that topic in my environmental history class right now.
It's very interesting.
I have learned that it might not... There is some... You can put Pittsburgh cleaning up on legislation, but it was actually mostly the cause of natural gas coming into the city. And more Pittsburghers using natural gas to power their homes.
That makes sense.
Instead of coal. Yeah. But anyways, it is short, but is there anything else you want to add before we finish out?
Check out Westview Borough's website, specifically the history section, because yours truly wrote it, and I'm very proud of it, because... You know, 6 years ago when I first started there was not a whole lot. And now you could actually go research it. And one of the highest compliments that I ever received from working at Westview was I got letters from elementary school kids. And they said that they loved the website and they were doing a project on Westview Park. And could I please send them pictures and information? And that was awesome, because that's what it's there for.
Yes.
Not for the glory. My information should be accessible.
Yes.
So yeah, check out Westview's website. There's a lot of really cool photos and things from the archives on their website still.
There are some really cool pictures of Westview Park during its peak.
It would have been fun.
After, yeah.
I wish I could have experienced it. I'm sorry, you know, not much of a Kennywood guy.
This is Aubriana Bench. I'm interviewing Andrew Bench.
WRCT.
Thank you for coming in, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
I'll see you at home later tonight. All right.
Fine.
Bye.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to PA@WRCT. Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to PA@WRCT.org.
You're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT 88.3 FM. Today, we're going to be talking to Maxwell Jones, PhD student in the Computer Science Department at Carnegie Mellon University, about AI. Thanks for coming on the show, Max.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Arjun. I'm super excited to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I started my undergrad at CMU, actually, Carnegie Mellon, doing an AI major. So I was in the Computer Science Department doing an AI major, and I also actually did an additional math major. After that, I did a master's in machine learning in the machine learning department at CMU, which was super fun. So I guess for my master's work, I did some research on style transfer with generative models for images. So this is like, you can think of generating an image, and you want to generate an image in a certain style. And so the problem was kind of some specific version of that. During undergrad, I did some research as well. Not as much, but I did some theoretical machine learning research because I liked math, so I thought maybe I would like some theory. I ended up not liking it as much, but it ended up being cool. And I also did some fairness and bias research during undergrad. So you can think of, like, you know, after a model is trained, you know, does it work the same on people of different races? What kind of correlations are there between captions outputted by a model and biases that humans have or biases that might be in the data? So after that, I started a PhD in the School of Computer Science, actually in the Machine Learning Department. But I'm co-advised by one advisor in the Machine Learning Department. So it's like Ruslan. He is like a super well-known, well-respected person in machine learning. He invented some of the seminal work in machine learning. So his PhD advisor was Geoffrey Hinton, who's like very well-known and like just got a Nobel Prize recently. So that's exciting. And I'm also co-advised with Junyan Zhu, who's in the Robotics Institute. And he does more generative model stuff. So I worked with him during my master's. And I guess now I'm kind of interested in sequential decision making or agentic processes for vision, creative tasks. And I guess my long-term plan is to work in some video editing. So how can we make video editing easier for creators? How can we create tools to kind of be a prayer programmer or to help creators make cool stuff with videos? So, yeah.
Sure, that's really cool stuff. So all of the new talk these days has been about large language models like ChatGPT, and now the news about DeepSeek. Could you give a quick explanation to the audience on sort of how large language models work for the layman?
Yeah, sure. So I guess at their core, they take in words, right? Like I'll say, I don't know, what team did Michael Jordan play on when he was playing basketball? And so it takes in a sequence of words, and then it outputs a sequence of words. So this example could be like, maybe it'll output, oh, Michael Jordan played basketball for the Chicago Bulls. And maybe it'll even give you more information, like, you know, he played in predominantly in the 90s where he won 6 championships. From an input-output standpoint, that's what's going on. And then, like, more formally, you kind of have some neural network, which is really just like a large set of numbers, weights, whatever you want to say. It's a function that takes in these words, transforms them into numbers, into vectors, and then does a bunch of operations on them, and then outputs the words. And so I guess there's all this talk of training. Basically, how like a large language model is trained is you just get sequences of words from somewhere. So typically this is like from the internet, and then you train the model to be able to predict the sequences of words that you've seen so far. Right, so maybe on the internet, there's sequences of words like, oh, you know, what was Michael Jordan's favorite game to play? Well, he loved playing basketball. Maybe you train on that data. And I guess nowadays, the large part of large language models comes from the fact that you're training on whatever millions, billions, even like a trillion like words or tokens, which is like a kind of small building block that a word is made out of to the model.
Thanks for that explanation. So over the past couple of years, LLMs, ChatGPT, and generative AI in general, kind of like some of those generative image models that you were talking about earlier, have really come into vogue in the mainstream media, and everyone's hearing about it, and there seems to be a lot of investment dollars and work going into it.
Yeah.
But machine learning as a discipline has existed for decades now.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the factors that you think have created this shift or explosion in interest in machine learning more broadly, as well as technical innovations that you think kind of led us here? What are the most important ones?
So there's kind of two things. So the first is like ease of use. So I think ChatGPT was a big watershed moment for generative AI, as a lot of people will say. And one of the main things is because anyone could use it for free on their computer. Right? So it didn't require a special hardware or you to kind of have research machines to run the like neural networks or run the machine learning models. All you had to do was log into a website and then type something and something would come back. Right? And so that's kind of what led to many millions of people trying it out for the first time. And I think that's what led to like people investing, saying, oh, this can be very useful. Because people started to notice that, you know, ChatGPT knew about so much stuff. It knew about whatever use case they were trying to work on. And so then from, a more technical side, one of the main innovations with ChatGPT over previous large language models is this like idea of RLHF, or reinforcement learning for human feedback. And so without going into too much depth, I think the main idea here is that you don't only want to kind of reconstruct things you've seen online, but you kind of want to pick something that you think a human is really asking you about. So I guess the example that I like to go to for something like this is, let's say I train on a bunch of workbooks and a bunch of text from the internet. That's not a workbook, right? So maybe a workbook has questions like, oh, what is the capital of the United States? Followed by, oh, what is the capital of France? And maybe other things have words like, what is the capital of the United States? Followed by Washington, D.C. And so as a user, if I input in ChatGPT, what is the capital of the United States? I want it to give me the answer, Washington, D.C. But the training data might say, well, it's equally likely to predict what is the capital of France as the next line, because it's seen those two lines next to each other a lot in the training data. So this idea of reinforcement learning with human feedback is saying, well, actually, you should really output Washington, D.C. in these examples, because you should kind of have an idea. You should learn what humans are looking for. And so there was kind of some seminal work in that domain that really made ChatGPT super good.
Yeah, so there's a lot of talk about resource consumption with AI and how mm-hmm. that's going to be a growing concern as time goes on. And obviously, NVIDIA has become one of the world's largest companies off the back of powering AI training and inference. Can you explain to the audience a little bit why it requires such massive computing resources to run these models and why these resources are so specialized to companies like NVIDIA?
So I guess, yeah, there's two questions. One is, why does it require so much resources? And so one of the things that like the AI community has found in the last 10 years is that the way to have a better model is to have a bigger model trained on more data. So if you want to have a general model that can do a lot of stuff, the best way to achieve that is by getting a lot of high quality data and training a very large model. And so improvements in the field of large language models, or just general models in general, which is what like a normal user wants to use, like a general model that can do a lot of stuff, then the best thing they do is make a bigger and bigger model that's trained with more and more data. And so as you get bigger and bigger models, right, the cost of consumption goes up. And so it's actually one thing that's important to note here is that the training of the model isn't actually like the majority of the bulk of the consumption. What's the bulk of the consumption is users querying the model, you know, millions or hundreds of millions of times, whereas you only have to train the model once. So I think that's basically the real reason. And then this NVIDIA question is kind of a separate question. So they have like the best like GPUs, graphical processing units that people can buy. And that's like a chip that you use to train a model. And so because they have the best things to use to train the model, and everyone wants to train the model, then they're super rich, right? So their main customer isn't like the layperson, like you or me or anyone who's trying to use these models. It's like OpenAI or Meta or other companies that are trying to train models at a very, very large scale who need to buy these in bulk, right? And they're like pretty expensive per graphical processing unit or GPU.
Cool. So one of the things that's been in the news a lot recently is DeepSeek, and I know you've looked into it yourself a little mm-hmm. bit. Can you explain what the hubbub was about with DeepSeek? Why was it such big news that they came out with their model?
So I guess, like, just going from what we were talking about before, like OpenAI has this, they have their ChatGPT, which everyone uses, which a lot of people use, which is like super valuable. And they've raised a lot of money, right? And when they talk to investors, they say, hey, we need all this money because training is super expensive, GPUs are very expensive, and the more money we have, the better we can train. We can hire good people to train our models, right? We can hire smart people to train our models. And so we need all this money, right? And then Meta and all these companies that are buying NVIDIA chips are saying, hey, we need all this money in order to train our models so we can have the best model. The assumption is, hey, you give us all this money now, we'll train our models, and then in the future, you're going to get your profits back because we're going to have these models and everyone's going to use them and there's going to be some pay structure and somehow you're going to get your money back. So DeepSeek was a model trained by this like DeepSeek team in China. It's like a quantitative firm. They do some large language model training also. So like the large language model isn't their profit structure. It's more about like, you know, doing stuff in the market, some kind of financial math stuff. And so they trained a model, which they open sourced. So that means like not only can you use it like via a website, like the actual weights themselves are online. So anyone could download the model in theory and run it kind of either not locally, but they could run it without having to pay DeepSeek at all because they have the weights. And so they trained this model, released it, open sourced it so anyone could in theory download the weights. And it was on par or almost on par with the top models from like these U.S. companies, so like OpenAI. I think the Meta model is not quite as good as the OpenAI model, or Google has a good model as well. And so I think the scare was if we give these companies all this money, however, like another company could train a model that's just as good or basically indistinguishable that people could use for free, then kind of where's the profit coming back? So I think about this as a reason for like all the big market hubbub, as opposed to, oh, it only costed X dollars to train the model. So I think something that a lot of people talk about is, oh, it only costs whatever, $5 million to train this DeepSeek model, whereas OpenAI kind of, you know, has asked for so much money. Right? But I think one thing that's good to separate is like the cost of training a model from the cost of the research and development to know how to train the model correctly, and the cost of trying a lot of stuff out before you do your final single training run, right? So this cost of research and development and figuring out, you know, what the best model looks like, how to get the best data, how to clean the best data, right? That's where like all the costs are, as opposed to a single training a single model, right? So I think something I like to think about is, you know, they're a kind of a quantitative finance company, right? So maybe, and the paper itself had like whatever 40 or 50 people on it. Right, so you can think, and they've been working on this kind of direction of machine learning for 4 or 5 years, right? So in the U.S., how much would the salary of 40 or 50 quantitative research finance people over 4 or 5 years cost? It's a lot of money, right? 40 people times 4 years times salaries north of $500K to $1 million to $2 million for a senior quantitative research person. So it's not as if this entire process costs $5 million. It costs significantly more. Right, but even with that being said, there's still a question of is this monetizable if there's always a free version of the top model, right? So that's still a question.
Interesting. So you would think that the human capital is like a pretty significant portion.
Yeah, that's the main portion of it is the human capital and also the capital needed to train different testing runs, right? So when I look at the DeepSeek model and I look at their tech report, every single part of the process is clearly, to me, optimized very thoroughly, and many things are tested. Right, so maybe let's say, I'll just say a number, there's 50 different things you could have tested. Right, they've tested all of those and figured out what works better than previous things for a lot of different parts. So that process of even testing those things, just the money to train different versions is going to cost whatever, 10x, 100x, the 5 million used for the final training.
Sure. You talked about open source models, and yeah, obviously DeepSeek V3 and R1 are open source models, mm-hmm, where the weights are publicly available. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as an increasing trend in AI, and what are some of the impacts of having these large models open sourced?
So this is actually a good question. And so the head of the machine learning department is Zico Coulter, and he's one of the board members for OpenAI. So I think he had some interesting takes about open source versus closed source as well. So I guess there are some companies that swear by open source, some companies that basically like only do closed source. So an example is like these DeepSeek, all of their model weights are open, right? Meta, all of the model weights are open. OpenAI, no model weights are open. But at the same time, there's kind of a continuum of open source, right? So maybe on the completely closed end, right, is something like OpenAI, where all you can do is input text and output it, the model will output something. You don't know how big it is. You don't know how many weights there were. You don't know what it was trained on. You don't know anything about it. Right? A little bit farther down this kind of trajectory is like a Meta model or a DeepSeek model where they'll give you the weights, but they won't tell you what training data was used to train the model, right? And they'll give you a paper saying, hey, these are all the things we did, right? But they'll say the data set contained this many words, but we're not going to tell you where it came from, right? So this also isn't actually fully reproducible, right? Because you don't actually have the data that they used. And then on the other end is kind of something that's completely open. And so completely open, I think, there's some examples. I think the Allen Institute for AI has some completely open stuff, where that means they tell you the data set, you know, they tell you what the model looks like, they give you the model weights, and they write a tech report about everything that happened, as well as all their failures. And given that information, you have enough information to perfectly reproduce their model, right? So you should ideally be able to get up to some level of error, like the error, like the exact same weights or very similar weights, right? So when people say DeepSeek is open, it's definitely more open than an open AI model, but it's not open in the sense that given the DeepSeek paper and infinite money, someone could reproduce their model exactly because the data is not released.
Interesting. Just a reminder, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Arjun Das, here with Maxwell Jones, AI researcher at CMU. Speaking of CMU, obviously a lot of really cool ML research happens here that you're aware of. What are some cooler research or researchers that you would like to shout out as being particularly interesting at the moment?
So I guess I first want to shout out, I think my lab members are doing some really cool stuff. First, Shengyu Wang, who is working on data attribution. So this is actually a very hard problem. The idea is, let's say I trained my image generator on 5 billion images from the internet. And then I say, hey, generate me an image of a cat wearing a top hat. And I have some, and I get some cat wearing a top hat. Like, the question is, can I figure out which of those training images were very influential into making that cat with a top hat? And I guess the main idea is, if I know that, then maybe I can give those artists some residual pay, right? So you can think of an artist opts into getting trained, to using their data to train with a model. And then from there, if the model generates an image that was based upon their work, they get some residual fee, right? This is actually an incredibly difficult problem from a mathematical and machine learning perspective. So Shengyu is doing some really cool work. I think also Gaurav Parmar and Nupur Kumari are doing some really cool stuff in the field of image translation and customization. So image translation is like, say you have an image of a car during the day. Can I turn it into an image of a car, like, raining, right? Or can I turn it into an image of a car when it's cloudy outside? And so one application of this is like data augmentation for self-driving, right? So I guess more concretely, if I have a bunch of self-driving videos from the day, it'd be cool if I could generate self-driving videos during rain so I can use that to train to make a very strong self-driving car that I think will work in all cases. And then customization is kind of the idea of, I have some personal images. Maybe I have some photos of myself. Maybe I have some selfies of myself. And then I want to generate like a high-resolution professional headshot of myself, right? And so in this case, I'm only giving the model 5 to 10 images of myself as opposed to whatever it was trained on, like billions of images. And then can it use that kind of scarce data and its general knowledge about humans to then output a photo of me, but like, say, in a professional suit and in a headshot?
A lot of really neat stuff. Thanks. So speaking of these generative image and video models that you and your lab are working on, what do you see as some of the important implications in the future and potential uses? Obviously, it's hard to know exactly what's going to happen in the future, but where do you see the impact of this work?
So I think there's a few things. So I think there's kind of two areas that this technology can be very useful. And I think it's maybe a little bit different than what people think. So when people think of like, oh, I have like an image generation tool, they think of like, oh, like it's very negative. It's usually from a very negative connotation of, oh, it's going to replace someone. And so I think of it more as like someone with these tools can generate cool stuff much faster and can iterate on stuff much faster. So I'll give you two examples of like an expert with these tools being able to iterate much faster in the movie world, right? So first, like the movie Into the Spider-Verse, right? There was experts on the team that was like kind of designing, and they had AI tools that they could use to speed up their design process, to try things faster. And so to me, the result of this kind of technology is that experts can make a high quality movie faster, right? So we don't have to wait whatever 6 years for the next Into the Spider-Verse movie. which no one would like to do. We'd like to have a really high-quality version in 3 years, right? That's as high-quality as a version in 6 years without the technology, right? So I kind of think of it as a continuation of any image editing software in some sense, where it speeds up the use for creators. Another use case is helping people who are typically non-creators create high-quality stuff that they can be proud of and learn more quickly, right? So one example for me is, like, in the future, I'd love to make more YouTube videos, right? But some software like Adobe Premiere Pro or other video editing software is very, there's a lot of different tools you could use. It's very cumbersome, right? So it would be good if, like, AI could help me as a creator or someone that wants to be a creator create very high-quality videos, like, immediately, without all the overhead, right? Or could help me learn more quickly what a good quality video looks like. So I think this is another use case, is kind of helping people who are not in the space or who want to get in the space, like, create things more quickly.
You speak of generative AI almost as like a force multiplier, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah, something like that. And there's also like 3D assets or gaming is also another example that's kind of along these similar lines.
Yeah, so for our listeners who aren't machine learning researchers at CMU, but still want to use AI for positive impact in their own work, what are some ways that they can go about learning how to use these tools to boost their output?
That's a good question. So there's a few things, I guess. So first of all, the internet is a great tool. So you can look up stuff. Nowadays, if I want to learn about something I don't know that much about it and I can't find it, like, via Google search, I'll just ask ChatGPT, like, hey, I want to learn more about X thing. What are a set of things I should look up? Also, there's different AI tooling, especially in the generative AI space, that's more accessible, that doesn't require super fancy hardware. So for example, a tool might be like Comfy UI is a tool. It's like a user interface for kind of using these models. So I think that has like a relatively low barrier to entry as opposed to like trying to code up something fancy.
Sure. In general, what are some tasks that you see AI being really good at, and what are some tasks where it really still has some room to go?
So I guess, I was talking with some other like PhD friends about this. It seems like tasks where you're kind of just sitting around and like doing something on a computer like should be very automatable, especially kind of tasks that are not super long term. We were kind of sitting down and like typing or doing something that doesn't require any like interaction with the real world as much. So one example might be like writing reports, like writing write-ups. Any write-up where really where what you're doing is kind of looking things up online, synthesizing information, writing things up in a certain format that's very nice, I think AI could be very good at. Right? Another example might be in the coding world, it might be kind of fixing a single error in like a coding library or like a some kind of repository. I think that kind of task AI can be and will be very good at. Right? All these tasks are in some ways still kind of short term in the sense that you don't have to do stuff for a very long time. So some things that AI in general is bad at is just anything in the real world. Right? So robotics as a field hasn't hit its kind of ChatGPT moment, as some researchers like to say, where it's very widely adopted and everyone is kind of using kind of generalist robots, right? And so the reason for that is just manipulating things in the real world is just harder, right? It's harder to iterate. It's harder to test a robot 10 times than it is to test some code 10 times. It's just fundamentally harder, takes longer. Right? So I think that's an area where AI still has a long way to go. And then another area where AI might have a long way to go is kind of long horizon tasks, right? So I think one example is AI can perfectly pass maybe a job interview for coding where you're asked two very short questions. But can AI perform like a long-term like intern? Maybe this is more unclear. Right? And so I think people are working towards kind of this direction. But anything where there's super, super long like content that you have to create, I think is like much more difficult. Yeah, there's some types of things that AI I think might be like not as good at in kind of the social, like human aspect. So maybe like being able to synthesize new memes or something, like something that's like you have to be really in tune with the culture to do. But I could eat my words on that one. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Watch out for the new meme AI model dropping in 2025, right?
No. Oh, God. Well, I guess we'll see. People will definitely try.
Yeah. I'm sure it's going to come soon if it hasn't already.
Yeah. I know there's like YouTube creators that just do like they do video essays where they like synthesize the video and like the and the script with AI. And so that's kind of, I don't know, I like a use case where kind of you kind of have thoughts as a human and then you use AI as a mode to try to, you know, get them out there more quickly.
Yeah.
Or iterate sense. On them more quickly. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember hearing a really interesting perspective on what AI is good at and bad at, that things that are like really easy or instinctual for humans actually end up being the things that AI is bad at.
Yeah, like, it's weird.
You could teach a 5-year-old to catch a ball, but to teach a robot like how to move its motors to like, I don't know, play hockey or something is like very difficult. But you see little kids playing hockey everywhere.
Yeah. It's one of those things. I think I forgot who it was. Maybe Ilya or some big AI mogul said it has like this kind of jagged intelligence where the point is it can do highly intelligent things, but it still cannot do very simple things. So like it learns in a different way than humans are used to, in the sense that it can do very complicated things while still failing to do very simple things. Right. And so then the question is, how can you augment an AI to know when that's the case or to do what that, or kind of to not have to do that kind of thing. So one example might be like, multiplication, right? Like you can make an AI that knows a lot of stuff, but then still maybe struggles with 10-digit multiplication. Right? But if the AI says, hey, you gave me a 10-digit multiplication question, let me just use a calculator. Like maybe you can kind of patch some of these issues.
So as AI has been in the popular mind for a few years now, more so than ever before, do you think it's here to stay in terms of how people think about it, or do you think this sort of initial burst of attention is going to go away?
I don't know. I think it's here to stay. And it's easy for me to say that as someone who works in the field, but especially after talking to like other people who aren't in the field or are even in high ranking roles at CMU or other places where you'd expect them to be more likely to say that it's not here to stay. I think everyone thinks it's here to stay. And maybe the reason is that, especially this generative AI stuff, it's so easy to use and it can give so much value that value will kind of like circumcede any attempts to completely like stop it, is in my opinion. I think there's so much value that it can be output to make people's lives easier that people will just continue to use it. And whether the people think about it differently is another question. But I think there's a lot of value in people continuing to use this tool. But one thing I will say is with humans in general, like we go through cycles of having super cool new technology or something that's super cool and new, not knowing how to use it. And then after we know how to use it, it takes us even longer to realize why it might be good or bad. And then to kind of die down a little bit using it. So one example might be like smartphones, for instance, right? So smartphones first came out, whatever, 2000s, right? They got so much hype. Everyone started using them, right? And to me, it's now or in the next 10 years that people are going to start being like, hey, it's actually really bad that I'm spending so much time on my phone. Can I find really good ways to not do this, right? Because we're not used to it. It's almost like a... It's like maybe like drinking in moderation or something, where when you're first introduced to drink, you don't even know what it is, right? So you're thinking, oh, like I can do this a lot. And once you start to realize the downfalls, it takes even longer to be like, okay, how can I work on this, right? So kind of humanity goes through these things as well. And so I think this is something that happened with smartphones, where people kind of use them a lot. We're kind of peaking in terms of how much we use them. And then people are kind of slowly being like, I actually really do enjoy like human connection. So in the last, whatever, year, I've heard more and more stories of people being like, yeah, I try to use my phone as little as possible, or I'm actively trying to stop using my phone, which is something that maybe wasn't as true 5 years ago. So I really think that AI will go through something similar, where kind of right now everyone is using it, and in the future, maybe next 5 years, 10, depends, timeline is hard to say when things move so quickly, it'll get even more widely adopted and people will use it for many, many tasks. And then maybe at some point people will be like, we're actually losing some stuff for using it so much. But I think this is... if it's going to happen, very far away.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been super fun.
Yeah. You've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm your host, Archin Das, and I've been here with AI researcher at CMU, Maxwell Jones. Thanks. Have a good one, folks.
So the bigger question is, how did the United States come to fight and sponsor and support these very bloody wars in both